Welcome to The Sit Down. I am Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. The Sit Down is the latest addition to our Raging Chicken radio podcast. On The Sit Down, we talk with activists, public intellectuals, investigative journalists, and rabble-rousers of all sorts to deepen our discussions, prepare us for the struggles ahead. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check out all our citizen journalism at RagingChickenPress.org. You can subscribe to Raging Chicken Radio on Podbean, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and iTunes, frankly, anywhere you get your podcasts. Subscribing to Raging Chicken Radio is one of the easiest things you can do to help support this podcast and all the work we do with Raging Chicken. If you want to help build a progressive activist media network for PA and beyond, you can become a member for as little as $2 a month. That's $2 a month, folks. That's less than the cost of a bad beer or an okay cup of coffee. Just go to RagingChickenPress.org and click Become a Member under the Support and Membership tab. Or if you're listening on Podbean, just click Become a Patron and you'll be on your way. Be sure to check out all the thank you gifts we have for each membership level while you're there. And as a reminder, we've got just a couple more days left in our special offer. If you recall, Ben Tupper joined as a member at the $15 a month level. And as a thank you to both Ben and to all of you new members, if you become a member between now and the end of the month, that's just a couple days away, the end of June, we will send you Ben's book, Greetings from Afghanistan, Send More Ammo, as a special thank you. You've got to join at the $5 a month level or above. Today on The Sit Down, Dr. Amy Lynch Biniak is back on the program to talk about the contract fight brewing in the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, or PASHE. Amy is a faculty member in the English department at Kutztown University, and her research and writing engages questions of pedagogy, literacy, and labor studies. Her forthcoming book, Contingency, Exploitation, and Solidarity, Labor and Action in English Composition, is a co-edited anthology with Seth Kahn and Bill Lolliker that explores the ways and means of labor reform on college campuses. She is the chair of the State ABSCUF Adjunct Faculty Committee, and she is the current editor of Forum, a peer-edited journal from the National Council of Teachers of English. Now, the faculty union, ABSCUF, has been working without a contract or an expired contract for almost a year. June 30th marks the end of one full year working without a contract. After refusing to negotiate for months, PASHE negotiators showed up to the June 10th negotiation session with ABSCUF with a contract proposal that, you know, seeks to fundamentally change or transform labor conditions in Pennsylvania's 14 state-owned universities. A transform is one of those words that PASHE has been trotting out now for quite some time. Currently, ABSCUF contract is considered by many in the higher education labor movement to be the gold standard when it comes to issues of parity, stability, and justice for adjunct faculty members. That by no means means it's perfect, but it means that it offers some of the best protections and pay parities and access to rights and job stability and so on. Now, PASHE is seeking to change all that. Now, in an episode of Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast on June 15th, I discussed PASHE's full proposal in detail. So if you're interested in getting into the weeds a bit, you can go check that out. At the core of PASHE's proposal is an attempt to divide and conquer the faculty, pitting tenured and tenure-track faculty against adjunct faculty. Now, Amy wrote a piece in her blog this past Friday called Why the Contract's Treatment of Temporary Faculty Members Matters to Tenure-Line Faculty. And in that piece, she makes a case for solidarity among adjunct, tenure-track, and tenured faculty. Her article is now also available on Raging Chicken Press as well. And I'm glad to have her on the program once again to talk about her article and ABSCUF's contract fight. Welcome back, Amy.
Thank you for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
Now, so we have in your piece that you posted up on your blog, it's now available on Raging Chicken 2 as well, you say that there are three changes in the contract that PASHE negotiators are proposing that are particularly alarming. So what are these changes? And walk us a little bit about why you see these as such big issues that faculty need to pay attention to.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be alarmed about in PASHE's contract proposal, but the three in particular that stand out to me concerning adjuncts are particularly egregious. The first is to increase the adjunct's workload from 4 courses per semester, that's 8 per year, to 5 courses per semester, 10 per year. The second
is to increase the cap on adjunct faculty, which currently stands at 25% of faculty, up to 30%. And finally, they would like to give all of our graduate students, whether MA or PhD, the ability to teach in our classrooms. Right now, we can have faculty graduate assistants, but we do not allow them to teach in the classroom. I think that all three of these individually have their own problems, which we can talk about, but in combination, they're particularly worrisome.
Well, that's a really good point. I mean, and I'm glad you kind of raised it in that way, because I do think that when you look at each one of these proposals, increasing the course load, allowing graduate students to teach, any one of them, frankly, you could see people say, well, okay, weighing it back and forth. But when you look at them as kind of part of a kind of systemic plan, if you will, they become all that much more troubling. So now, if we take just, for example, look at kind of the course load, we look at, say, the course load or graduate students teaching. Why are these particularly troubling? I mean, you could look at, just say, increasing to four to five classes and say, well, okay, look, these are folks that are kind of coming in. They're working on a part-time basis or a temporary basis, looking to cover these courses, and their focus is teaching. So what's wrong with kind of upping that a little bit, especially since, you know, they're not going to have the demands for research that your tenure line faculty would have?
I think that increasing course load has multiple negative effects.
First and foremost, I think about the fact that most of the time our adjunct faculty are given general education courses. Now, some of us who are tenure line and tenure track also teach these and love these. They're our bread and butter. But very often we push these off onto adjuncts because they're incredibly challenging to teach, for a variety of reasons. First of all, because you're usually teaching non-majors, and second of all, because they are big classes. I think about, for instance, you know, this the intro health course that all students must take. This is often a large lecture class that might have 50, 75, 100 students in it. So when we're talking about increasing a course load from four to five, what we're talking about is it just, you know, 5, 15, 20 students in them. Some of our adjunct faculty may find themselves teaching five classes that are each large lecture halls. So we're talking about an enormous increase in the amount of students, the amount of assignments they're grading, the amount of tests that they're having to produce. If you're teaching writing, oh my goodness, the amount of drafts and feedback you're going to have to give. So this is like exponentially, potentially increasing their workload.
Now, so if you're looking at, just so that people have a context for this, now, you know, in your field, my field, right, in composition, is that a lot of those intro classes, basically, a lot of those intro classes, which, as you suggest, normally, or very often, let's say, gets staffed by adjunct faculty members. So what's would be considered a normal course load, right? If you're looking at, say, best practices or best standards, like in the field of, say, composition, what are we looking at? It's like, what should be the course load of these faculty members?
The NCTE, the National Council of Teachers of English, recommends that any writing class be capped at 15 students per section. Mm-hmm. And that allows a professor to provide the kind of guidance and to choose the kind of pedagogies which we know are most effective in the classroom.
Work one-on-one with our students. We can assign multiple drafts and give feedback on each of those drafts. So we're talking, you know, if you're teaching a 4-4 course load, you know, you might have 60 students in a semester. But that already is not the case in PASHI school. Right now at Kutztown, for instance, our basic intro comp class 022 is capped at 20. 023 is at 22 this year. So we're already above that, teaching more than that. Were we to increase the course load for our adjunct faculty, so many students in a semester that they wouldn't help but have to adjust their pedagogical approach. They couldn't do the same sorts of things that they can do now. We're getting farther and farther away from what our fields tell us we need to do in order to best serve our students.
that drives home why this is an exponential increase. I mean, you're already talking, I know there are some Pasha universities that have class caps on the first year composition class, for example, of upwards of 30, right? So you're talking about double the national standards of best practices already. So by increasing the course load, you're talking about dramatically increasing the workload for those faculty members. Because as you say, you know, unlike what you have some Pennsylvania legislators would have us believe, that we sit here and we only work for, you know, 17 hours a week, because we, you know, each class we, you know, we have 12 credit hours per semester that we're supposed to be in the classroom, plus 5 hours of office hours, and that's all we work. They have absolutely no understanding of what actually the workload means, especially when you're talking about, say, a writing intensive classes or lab work that requires a lot of out of the class work. This is not the kind of, you know, kind of education delivery system where a faculty member shows up and just kind of gives a lecture for 1 hour, then goes away. Right. This is one where there's lots of hands on work with students on a daily basis.
I think general education courses especially involve more and more time outside of the classroom, at least from my personal experience. Again, because you're working with non-majors who you can't assume they have a foundation in your field, whatever it is you're teaching. You have to take extra time and care and attention. I think that 17-hour estimate is so laughable for so many reasons that, you know, if we have to document our hours in the classroom already. I forget what the old, but each the semester Snyder we have report. To document an estimate. Yes, the Snyder Report. We have to document the amount of hours we spend. And, oh my goodness, mine is usually at least 40 hours a week, if not more. And I can imagine that people who are teaching, you know, four sections of composition be hovering around 60, just from reading multiple drafts alone. The time is going to become our scarcest resource as, you know, if this proposal goes into effect.
Yeah, I was just having a conversation with some neighbors and family actually over the weekend, talking about this because ABSCUF was in the news once again, because there's a emergency legislative assembly session that is now being scheduled for August 25th, I believe, where faculty will consider taking a strike authorization vote. And so I was, you know, they were asking me about this and all, and they were asking about the workload question. And I told them, you know, when I first started and I had to fill out those reports, I had never kind of actually sat down and kind of worked out hours of work before I had to do them. And of course, as a new faculty member, I was, you know, nervous to do it right and wanted to make sure that I got all this down. So I documented. And there were two semesters that one was at 68 hours and the other one was at 72. Right. And I was just, you know, I remember looking at that as like, oh my God, you know, I never, you know, because you don't think about it. I don't think until you're asked to really quantify it. You know, see how much you're doing. And then I find out just a couple years later that those very legislators that are, condemning faculty for only working 17 hours a month, don't even look at those reports that are mandated by law. So they're not even using evidence to make their judgments when they're actually looking at the workload that we already take up.
And, you know, you mentioned research previously, and I think that's an important component to consider here as well. In the Snyder reports, one of the things we have to document is the hours spent towards research. And one of the ways that the state has been trying to rationalize its increased adjunct workload is saying, well, we would no longer require adjuncts to do any research. So that's fewer hours. Now, forget the fact that that doesn't mean they're dramatically going to be decreasing the number of hours they spend, right? Because they're going to, again, be putting in 40, 50, 60 hours a week anyway reading papers. But it worries me anytime you tell a teacher, don't research, you know, or that you researching isn't part of your job as a professor. Because one of the reasons I research is to stay up to date on my field, to know the best practices and the best information, to stay on that cutting edge for my students. And our adjuncts know that this is useful and necessary just as much as we do. And if we don't compensate them for that time, if we don't have that as part of their job, what are we saying? You know, it suggests that those
really aren't important, and the people who teach them don't really have to be skilled in any way, which of course is ridiculous.
Right. That's a great point in terms of some of the assumptions that are being made to about what it is that teaching is, you know, gets right to the core of what it means to teach. Like, if it's not simply just about walking into the classroom and reading a script. Right. It's not like, you know, that kind of delivery mechanism, but it's about a kind of a process of learning, an ongoing process of learning and engagement with students. What are the best practices? You know, I know that, you know, most universities, you have opportunities at both, not just like research in terms of writing books and articles and so on, but opportunities for, say, kind of professional development or kind of pedagogical development within departments or within universities. Right. Which are all part of, you know, what the ABSCoV contract looks at is kind of, you know, the research component, continually scholarly growth, where you're kind of expanding your awareness of what's going on in the field in order to bring that back to the classroom. So let me ask you this then. So if we got this on research, you got this increasing the course load. The other component there is not just increasing the number of courses being taught by adjunct faculty members, but you're talking about the percentage of adjunct faculty members growing, right, at Pashi, right? So right now you're moving from 25%, right? If, you know, again, if this proposal were to go through as the way it is now, if you're to move from where we are now, it's 25% cap on adjunct faculty member to a 30% cap, right? Plus, as you mentioned in the article, right? Plus graduate students entering the mix now as teachers, right? Why is that going to be like such an issue? I mean, you know, the argument is being made, right, at from Pashi's perspective, right? Just saying, hey, look, nationally, right? You know, we're way out of step with every other university, right? We've got such a low percentage of adjuncts, right, that we can afford to pop that up a little bit, right? So we can afford to kind of move it up like that to become, you know, to modernize our university labor systems to kind of more clearly mirror the way things are out there.
That argument always confounds me. It's so illogical. It's so irrational. Modernizing sounds great, right?
Except if by modernized you really mean turning higher ed into a factory system. They use words like modernize and mainstream and get us into step. But if we've been doing things in our system that are better than the rest of the nation, shouldn't we hold ourselves up as a standard? Couldn't we, as a higher education system in PA, say, hey, we're the model. Hey, parents, hey, students, hey, professors looking for gigs. Don't you want to come here because we're doing something better? We aren't falling into adjunctification that we see in the rest of the nation. So that idea of we can get into step with what the rest of the nation's doing, if what the rest of the nation's doing is unethical and bad for education, why would we want to be in step with that? That's a problem. And I think it's important to realize that it is a step towards turning us into a system of part-timers, of contingent faculty. You know, with graduate students added into the faculty, I really have no idea how high that percentage actually is. We say they're saying 30, but once you have MAs and PhDs, does that turn into 40, 45, 50% of the faculty being temporary? And, you know, flip that. Even if it hovers at, say, 35, you know, that means 65% of us are only tenure line. Mm-hmm. They don't advertise it that way, right? It's that other number. But what's really happening is they're shrinking tenure. This is an attack on tenure in a lot of ways that we've seen in other states, that they really want to turn us into a flex labor force rather than a professorate.
No, that's right. And I think that, you know, that whole idea of just looking at the national trends and pegging our universities to those national trends without asking the question about, is it ethical? Is it just? Does it work? I mean, because right now we could argue, like, just the reverse side of this is that, you know, why would we want to mimic, right, a system of failure? Right. Why would we want to mimic a system that is actually proving itself, right, to be unsustainable? Right. Why are we going to kind of follow those trends? And frankly, is that as much as Pashi wants to look at this and say, hey, you know, we need to kind of, no one else seems to be having problems. We've seen record unionization campaigns among temporary adjunct faculty members nationwide and unionization campaigns among tenured faculty members at an unprecedented rate, right? So if anything, like the trend nationwide is shifting in the other direction. The tide is coming back in, right, on kind of unionization, not where Pashi wants to take this system.
Yeah, if the system that they would like to emulate and move towards worked, we wouldn't see this record number of people unionizing because they are finding they're working so detrimental, both personally, you know, being able to have health care, being able to make rent, but also educationally. Has there been a move to this kind of flex labor force? Yes. Has it been working? No. Otherwise, there wouldn't be this big rebellion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, it does goes right to the core of how we think about what the importance of higher education, but then also I think how we relate to these kind of changes. Now, one thing you mentioned kind of a while back that I want to come back to in the second segment is this whole idea that, you know, why would we want to mimic kind of the worst case scenario? You know, it baffles me as well to say, you know, right now we're seeing this both in Pennsylvania, but then across the country, things like pensions, things like minimum wage, things like healthcare benefits, that there's this really strong discourse out there that says, hey, those people, usually they're pointing to unionized workers for that matter, those people have really good health care. I don't have really good health care, therefore I should take it away from them, right? As opposed to the argument that, hey, wait a minute, they've got good health care, I have crappy health care, right? Why don't I give them a call and find out how to get some of that for me too as well? So, I mean, that's
absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that's the kind of thing where, you know, it's the same kind of thing. It's like, well, just because we've got a higher educational system that is not working for the vast majority of faculty members and underserving our students, we shouldn't look at those folks who are kind of doing it right, which I would argue Pashi in many ways is doing things right up until now. Instead of doing that, well, then we should just rip it down, right, and make sure, like, we increase precariousness for everybody so that we're all in the same kind of race to the bottom boat, I guess.
Yeah, precisely. It's, again, I keep coming back to the it confounds me as a logical argument because it isn't logical. I don't understand why our leaders in Pennsylvania government wouldn't want us to be the model, you know, and again, we have been in many ways up until now. There are provisions in our contract that when I describe them to people from other universities outside of PA, they're just, they want to know how we did it. They want, they say, this is what we should all be doing. You know, we have a clause in our contract right now that is also under fire in the latest proposal that would allow adjuncts to be converted into tenure lines under certain conditions. You know, if they're very successful teachers and researchers, if they've been at the university for 5 years at least, if they have the approval of their departments, but if these are people who are already being hired back and are doing an excellent job, there's no reason to keep them there on a quote-unquote temporary basis. This has been something I've been so proud of that we have as a system. And of course, it too is on the chopping block in this latest proposal that, you know, it's something that we could hold up again as a model to other states. And instead they're saying, no, 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 we'd rather not be exemplary. we'd rather you know, just pick up this sad model of other states that's leading to rebellion. Huh.
right, exactly. And like, and I should be clear, when Amy is talking about on the chopping block, like we're talking literally. I mean, I wish I had the contract to hold up right now to you to show or what the proposal, not the contract, but the proposal. Those sections in ABSCOF's current contract, which provide a path to conversion to tenure line faculty status for a non-tenure track faculty or adjunct faculty, and those ones that talk about converting, excessive amounts of reliance upon adjunct faculty to full-time positions, they're literally struck out, right, in Pashi's proposal. They just want to eliminate all possibilities of increasing the stability of faculty members. Crazy.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's clauses like that and the caps on adjunct faculty and the course load that has allowed us to attract really high-quality adjunct faculty that, you know, I'm very proud to call my colleagues. But That's going to get harder and harder to do as Pashi, pushes with these proposals that really undermine what we've been able to build.
Absolutely. I would agree 100%. And so one of the things I want to do is that we're going to take a little break. And when we come back from the break, I want to kind of deal with another aspect of Amy's article here that I think is very important, not just for what's happening right now in the Pashi system, but in terms of how we think about moving forward and ensuring that we're not seeing additional rollbacks in terms of, you know, the stability of faculty members, of the decreasing rights of adjunct faculty, but we're actually kind of standing together to kind of protect higher education. And that has to do with, what's at the core, from my perspective, of Pashi's proposal is a divide and conquer tactic, right? Seeking basically to divide the faculty from on adjuncts on the one side and tenure line faculty on the other, and saying, hey, let those adjuncts go, right? In other words, sell them out, right? So that your life is going to be better. But as Amy argues, I think very persuasively in her piece, that this scenario where we sell out adjunct faculty members in order to kind of protect the tenure line status is actually just a big facade to begin with. So we're going to talk a little about that internal organizing a little bit, about why it's going to be necessary for tenure line faculty and adjunct faculty to stand together, and looking at the bigger picture about kind of protecting higher education as a whole. So this is The Sit Down. This is a project of Raging Chicken Radio. I'm Kevin Mahoney, the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We're going to be right back with Dr. Amy Lynch-Beniak, and we're going to be talking labor organizing and higher ed some more. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. President Grover Cleveland had a growing problem. The nation was in the midst of a deep depression. Unrest amongst working people was mounting. The workers at the Chicago Pullman Palace car factory had declared a boycott against the company. They were angry that their wages had been drastically slashed while the rents in Pullman's company town had stayed the same. The boycott of Pullman cars threatened to snarl railroads throughout the nation. And on this day in labor history, the year was 1894. President Grover Cleveland signed the law that declared Labor Day a national holiday. He hoped setting a day aside in recognition of labor would help appease frustrated workers. The bill had been rushed through Congress. It passed both the House and Senate unanimously. But the idea for Labor Day did not start with D.C. politicians. Working people themselves conceived the idea of the holiday. Two men with very similar sounding last names are both credited with coming up with the idea of a Labor Day. The first was Matthew McGuire. He was a machinist and secretary of the New York Central Labor Union. His birthday was also today in labor history. That year was 1850. The second person credited with calling for a Labor Day was Peter McGuire, a carpenter. The very first Labor Day celebration took place in New York City on Tuesday, September 5th, 1882. The goal was to demonstrate the strength and the spirit de corps of the trade and labor organizations. 5 years later, Oregon became the first state to officially declare a Labor Day holiday. More than two dozen other states had founded similar holidays by the time the National Labor Day was declared. For more than a century, Labor Day has been set aside to remember those who fought for a better life for themselves and their children, and to remember the struggles and celebrate worker solidarity. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's The Sit Down. This is Kevin Mahoney. I am the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Today, we're talking to Dr. Amy Lynch-Beniak once again about the conditions of adjunct faculty in higher education. In particular, we're looking at the current contract proposal from the negotiators from the PA State System of Higher Education, ABSCUF, which is the faculty union of the 14 state-owned universities, has been in contract talks now for over a year, been working about almost a year when it comes to June 30th, a year without a contract, or an expired contract, we should say. And Pashi once again has in its sights what I would say is the adjunct faculty, looking for ways of turning this system, this state system of higher education, into, you know, much more of a, you know, assembly line system where you have academic peace workers delivering kind of most of the educational content. Now, of course, Dr. Amy Lynch-Biniak, Amy is pushing back on that hard, and her recent article, Why the Contracts Treatment of Temporary Faculty Matters to Tenure Line Faculty, is an attempt, is a call for solidarity from, in my perspective, to say that, you know, look, tenure track faculty and adjuncts alike are in the same boat when we're looking at this contract proposal as you're moving forward. So Amy, let me ask you this. So as much in the first segment, we talked a lot about the impacts of Pashi's proposal, potential impacts that would have on the quality of education, about faculty workload, and the conditions of those adjunct faculty members, right? Yeah. And the impact that it has on higher education as a whole. Now, one of the things that's interesting about your piece, it's not simply an account of what's in the proposal, but it's written very much to those tenure line faculty, and you're making a case for them kind of standing with their adjunct colleagues as we move forward in these contract negotiations. So can you talk a little bit about why are you writing this to the tenure line faculty?
Sure. I think understandably so, there's a lot of fear among faculty, both our temporary or adjunct faculty and our tenure line faculty. We're afraid of what's going to happen to our healthcare. We're afraid of what's going to happen to our salaries. And I think part of what the tactic of Pashi is to use that fear to divide us. So it's easier to get the concessions they want in a contract. That if tenure track faculty and tenured faculty are afraid enough of how their own conditions are going to deteriorate, they might then be willing to say, yeah, okay, we concede to these terrible labor conditions for adjuncts. There's fewer of them. There's all sorts of ways we can rationalize this in our minds. Oh, it won't really affect education, they try to say. And again, I understand the fear, but I think we have to realize that it's a tactic, that we're being manipulated. And that, in fact, the way that adjuncts are treated very much affects the way that we'll be treated. It will affect our own working conditions as well. Can't give in to that manipulation that's meant to make us more malleable.
Well, on one hand, we could look at this, to kind of play, I don't even call it devil's advocate here, but, you know, some of the arguments that you hear from tenured faculty are really focused on some very narrow, what I would say, kind of self-interest, right? Looking at these kind of contract proposals where, of course, this is not new. This happened, again, the last round of negotiations back in 2012. We had the same kind of thing on the table, looking to create a whole new tier of faculty members that were kind of, academic peace workers, like once again, part-time faculty members, precarious labor conditions. And faculty, tenure line faculty have kind of seen this before and they're kind of mulling this over. And I'm not kind of talking about everyone, but there's those who say, hey, look, I'm looking at my job and I want to make sure happens is that my job is protected, right? That my conditions are not going to change. And then maybe this is what I need to do. Maybe I need to sell out my adjunct colleagues, right, in order to kind of, keep the status quo for me. I mean, how do you engage with that? I mean, because you know this full well.
Yeah.
There are those whose primary concern is making sure that their own little world in academia is taken care of. Beyond that, they don't want to hear about higher education, about labor. They see these big issues when really they just want their own kind of job and their own conditions to remain the same.
Oh, goodness. There's so many ways to respond to that. I have an issue with it. So you're going to have to stop me if I ramble. But I think the most obvious response is just to talk about the ethics. That when we talk about adjuncts, we're not talking about some abstract notion. We're talking about people who also have to worry about debt and they're, putting their children through college and their health care. So when we're looking out for your own self-interest, if you put that as the priority, you have to realize that you're doing real material damage to real people.
And the whole concept of a union is to say we're stronger and we're more able to make sure everybody gets what they need if we're in this together. That, you know, these people are our colleagues. They are professionals. They're not just, disposable teacher bots. So we have to resist that idea of every man for himself. You're also less likely to get a good contract for yourself if it's every man for himself, right? Unions are formed for a reason, because they have more power to protect the interests of labor, to get equity and fairness when we work together. So that's my kind of what I think is the obvious first reaction. But
we can look at it from a selfish perspective as well.
If you think you're protecting yourself by taking that kind of stance, in the long term, you're really not.
Well, I look at some of the contract proposals that come out of PASHI. You know, we really, really focus so far on, these three specific proposals when it comes to adjunct faculty, right? Talking about the increase in the course load, the increased percentage of adjunct faculty at the universities, and allowing for graduate students to teach at PASHI universities. So we've been focused primarily on those. But for me, it's like, again, you were emphasizing having to look at this systemically. And I think that if we look at the contract proposals overall systemically, there's a case to be made that tenure line faculty are in the target too here. I mean, yes. PASHI is trying to remove sabbatical time, remove the time that faculty can get and go out and do research, right? To kind of write their books, mm-hmm. and write their articles. So PASHI wants to cut the number of sabbaticals. PASHI also wants to cut the professional development funds, which allow faculty to do research and so on. PASHI also wants to erode kind of healthcare, right, conditions. They want to force faculty members to teach distance education classes, right? So there's a whole bunch of other things that are in that contract proposal, which suggests that, if you focus solely on wanting to sell out your adjunct faculty colleagues, right, you think that's going to make you safe, even in their own proposal. There's no safety there.
It's not. And we are more likely to be able to protect things like healthcare coverage that's reasonable for all of us if we have adjunct and tenure line faculty working together. There's power in those numbers. And I think another thing that's being eroded by this contract, it when you read between the lines, is faculty governance, right? That the educators are will no longer be able to shape what education looks like on a campus. That, how much are our voices as tenured or tenure track faculty going to matter if we become a tiny portion of the faculty? Right, because really, we already talked about the cap, how it's being increased, and now we'll have graduate students teaching. When we become closer and closer to the minority, it's easier to ignore us, and it's easier to say that our input doesn't matter. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And we already see this again in some of the proposals in that contract. And like, I just like to direct folks to, like, once again, back on June 15th, when I did a solo episode of Out the Coop, that I'll warn you ahead of time, you need a couple cups of coffee in order to get through, because I get into the weeds on the contract proposal. But there's, when you talk about faculty governance, right? I mean, one of the aspects of shared governance, which again, this means virtually nothing to the vast majority of the public, right? When you hear shared governance, what that actually means internally and why that matters is a very abstract concept, right? It comes across as jargon, right? And this is not just in higher education. This is true in any business, right? If you were to suddenly throw out terms which mean something within a particular industry and ask the public to weigh in on this, it's not gonna resonate, because there's no place to put it. But shared governance is basically saying, hey, look, since we're talking about education, those people who are trained in education, trained to think about ideas, trained in the content areas, trained in how to go about teaching this content, we should have an input into the curriculum of the university, right? The idea is like, yes. If you've got people, train engineers out there, right? Ideally, the people who are driving the train have some experience knowing how to drive a train, right? I mean, you don't basically get a corporate CEO, right, off the street and throw them at the center of the locomotive, and you're going to end up with disaster, right? Same kind of deal here.
Absolutely.
And we see that, you know, the fact that there's moves to have university presidents being able to basically take faculty and kind of move around departments with no faculty input, to have them forced to teach distance ed, forced to teach summer school classes, and even to some degree, you know, having an input about which classes get taught and what's going to be the best for those students, coming from, you know, in many cases, university presidents who have less and less experience in actually being in the classroom, that are almost our, you know, corporate CEO versions in higher education.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so important that the people who are trained educators have some say in what the face of education looks like. And that's already become more and more difficult. We've seen this happen to our fellow teachers in the secondary education system, in the primary education system, with things through the standardized testing movement, through merit pay, things like that, where they have less and less control over what they can do in their classrooms. And I don't think it's at all an exaggeration to say that that has been creeping into higher education. Absolutely. And the fewer of us there are, and the more that our input into faculty governance and to shaping the curriculum, the more that shrinks, the more we're going to see education that is modeled after big businesses rather than you know, what good teaching looks like.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, it's, you know, one of the things that we've got going for us here in Pennsylvania, especially in the state system of higher education, is that, you know, the faculty are unionized, that you can't have administrators or CEOs, whatever you want to call these people, they cannot just by dictate fundamentally alter the quality of education in this state. Right now, as I mentioned on the onset, that you have there was another round of negotiations this past Friday on the 24th. According to the union, those negotiations once again did not go very well, and so ABSCUF has now set a August 24th, I believe, date for a strike authorization vote. Now, again, everything that you'll see, nobody wants to go out on strike. This is not the goal. The goal is a fair contract, which protects the integrity of quality of education, that keeps the faculty whole, but looks like we're moving in that kind of direction. So, you know, right now, let's just say, for example, that we don't get any movement on negotiations, that Pashi becomes insistent that we got to have this two-tiered faculty, that we basically have, we just got to turn a bunch of our faculty into adjuncts. What do you think that means for these negotiations and for the possibility of a job action come the fall?
Personally, I find that proposal of this two-tiered system untenable. And I'm tenured faculty, and I'm willing to walk. I'm willing to strike. And I hope that many of my fellow tenure track and tenured faculty are as well on an issue like that. I think that it's important that we're willing to resist that. And I know many of us feel very passionately about that resistance. We know from past experience when Pashi proposed something similar in previous contract negotiations that tenure track faculty were willing to come out in number and walk and demonstrate and show that they did not want this kind of two-tiered system. And we were able to stave that off. We were successful. And I think that success has empowered us. And I think it means that many of us will be willing to walk if Pashi pushes this agenda.
Well, I'll tell you, once again, we know that across the state system on all 14 campuses of the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, certainly faculty are preparing to do so. At Kutztown University campus, we're doing this too as well, are making preparations in the event of that there is a strike. And I hope you're right. I know certainly this is, as a faculty member in Pashi, I know I will absolutely be on the picket line in a snap if Pashi is going to insist upon dividing our faculty members and moving forward. And I should say again, I want to make a correction. It's August 25th will be the emergency legislative assembly meeting in which faculty will decide whether or not to authorize a strike. Now, just for everyone out there, what that means, if faculty at August 25th do authorize a strike at the legislative assembly, that will still have to go to the full membership for a vote. So if faculty vote on the 25th to authorize a strike, we're still looking at a little time between then and the possibility of a job action. Again, all hopes are on the negotiations process, that the PASHA negotiators come to their senses, but also all, you know, hope goes to faculty members out there who are in the process of organizing. And the call goes out to those faculty members who are on the fence about what they feel about this possibility of strike. I certainly feel it's about time to stand up and draw the line and say, we will not cross this line when it comes to defending public higher education in the state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah. And I would say to those faculty who are wary, again, if you are afraid of things like if we're on strike, paying your bills, remember that APSCEF has emergency funds that, again, we're a union, so we're here to take care of each other to make sure that nobody falls. We're going to pick each other up. Want to remember that any labor action is protected by law. So no employer can, for instance, not renew your contract because you take part in a union job action. Sometimes the safest place for you to be is in the company of your colleagues as they walk the line.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. And go right back to that question of fear. Is the best way to kind of break that fear is get involved, to get involved with a community of people who are fighting to defend higher education, so that you know that you're not just standing there alone, that there's people standing right there with you that got your back. So anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney. I'm the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. That's going to do it for this week's The Sit Down. Just want to let you know, in the coming weeks, given the size of this issue in Pennsylvania, we're talking about a union of, you know, nearly 5,000 members serving over 100,000 students in the state system of higher education. This has the potential to be really precedent setting nationwide when it comes to the defense of public higher education. So we're gonna watch this closely. We're gonna have some other people on the Sit Down and also an Out to Coop to talk about adjunct faculty organizing and the defense of public higher education. So look for that in the coming weeks. Just as a program note for next week, that would be July. We're into July already. 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th. Going to wish you a kind of a happy 4th of July weekend. We will be pre-recording next week's Out to Coop a little bit early. I'm sorry, Out to Coop and the Sit Down a little bit early. But we will bring you some programming while we're on a little bit of a hiatus. Then we'll be back to really get into the fight for higher education and beyond. So, Amy, thanks once again for joining us here on the Sit Down.
As usual, a pleasure. Thank you, Kevin.
All right. This is Kevin Mahoney, once again, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. If you like what you hear here, go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab and click on Become a Member. You can become a member for as little as $2 a month. Or if you're listening on Podbean, that's rcpress.podbean.com. You can just click the Become a Patron button at the top and it'll take you right to our page. Help support this awesome, awesome opportunity to build out progressive, independent media for PA and beyond. This is Kevin Mahoney signing off.
See ya!